Delighted to be with you this morning. I'm extremely sorry that I'm not with you in person. There is a complete power failure between Oxford and Didcot. So I spent 2 happy hours at Didcot, at Oxford Station this morning, hoping to get in. My marvellous IT colleagues and the great people of Waltham put this together. I'm sad as a person, but I'm no more sad than all of you, and that's because we all love numbers. We are all a community of complete dorks, and that's something that we should celebrate together. Now, I'm going to begin by doing something that I would do if I was with you, and I'm going to do it anyway, even though I'm not. For this, I'm going to need a little bit of help from one of the marvellous people at Waltham who's going to count the number of people who give particular responses to some questions. I'm going to begin with 3 multiple choice questions, and simply they are: what income does it take to be in the top 10%? How much richer are we now than we were in 1948? And then, this is a very technical and subtle question: how many gym slip mums are there in the UK? It's a technical question derived from the red top tabloids. Now, let me specify them a bit more carefully. Imagine that you are one part of a childless couple. Now, that may be a fond memory for some of you, or a dearly held ambition for others. But imagine that's where you are, you're one part of a childless couple. And the question is, what net income, the after taxes and social security benefits, do you need to be in the top 10% of the distribution of income in the UK? Do you need 40,000 a year, 60,000 a year, 80,000 a year, 100,000 a year, or 125,000? I hope that the question is clear. Imagine that you're one part of a childless couple. If you add the incomes of both members of the couple together, what net income would that family need to be in the top 10% of the UK income distribution? 40, 60, 80, 100, or 125,000? So here I'm going to need one of my friends at Waltham to do some counting. We'll start in the middle. So raise your hands if you think that the answer is 80,000. And it's very important that you all play the game, because if any of you don't vote, I'll ask somebody there to identify anyone who's not voted, and we'll get you to come and sing a song of my choosing at the front. So who thinks the answer is 80,000? Who thinks the answer is 60,000? Who thinks the answer is 100? Who thinks the answer is 40? And who thinks the answer is 125,000? Okay, now when we get to the end of the question, I'm going to ask my friend Wilfred to tell me what you thought the answers were. My guess is that most of you will have thought the answer was 80,000 or above. I've played this game hundreds of times in the last few years with all sorts of groups. The only group that's refused to play the game was the permanent secretaries, the heads of all of the civil service departments, and they insisted on answering anonymously on the sheets of paper, and I've seen their answers. I knew why. I will tell you the answers later on. The second question is this: how much has real national income, real GDP, grown by since 1948? So this is a measure of how much richer we are. So after accounting for inflation, has real GDP gone up by 50, 100, 150, 200, or 250%? Done before, we'll start in the middle. Who thinks that the answer was 150%, that real GDP has gone up by 150% since 1948? And who thinks the answer is 100%? And who thinks it's 200%? And who thinks it's 50%? And who thinks it's 250%? Okay, now the third question: how many gym slip mums? Now, gym slip mum is a very carefully defined technical term. It means a single parent receiving means tested benefits who is under the age of 18. Now, I'm making it slightly easier for you because I'm giving you the information that there are 780,000 single parents on means tested benefits in the UK. So are there 20, 40, 60, or 80,000 of those who are under the age of 18? So who thinks the answer is 40,000? 60,000. Who thinks it's 20,000? And who thinks that it's 80,000? And I'm hoping that some people on the other end of this phone will be able to give me the distribution of answers to those questions. Is that possible? Very good. But in that case, I'll wait until the end of the next bit of the talk, and I'll get the answers then. So let me move on. The single most important thing about numbers, I think, and this seems relevant to this conference, is the broad context into which we fit them. The context in which we think of the number is the only way we can understand it. And the single most important piece of context is normally whether a number is big or not. And this is something which is repeatedly misunderstood in the media and in the public at large. We had a story this morning about a particular change to smoking, which might save £8.4 million a year of the NHS's budget. And this was presented on the BBC's Today programme, perhaps the most serious radio programme in the whole world, as being a big number. Well, the NHS budget this year is likely to be £122 billion. So the suggestion that £8.4 million is a large number is one we should take with at least a pinch of salt. My favourite example, though, relates to a story from 12 years ago. The then quite new Labour government announced that it was going to transform childcare in the UK by providing an extra million childcare places. It was going to do this by spending £300 million to 5 million childcare places spread over 5 years. This received extraordinarily positive press coverage, both broadcast and printed. I was away on holiday at the time. I got back and looked at the numbers, thought it was slightly strange. The first thing to do with a number like this is divide it by the number of people it's meant to affect. So £300 million is meant to deliver 1 million places. We can all do that math. The answer is £300. But this was meant to last for 5 years. So you need to divide it by five as well, and that gets you to £60 a year, which already looks like quite a small number. But typically people think of the cost of childcare per week, so we need to divide by 52. Now, of course, that's a more subtle piece of arithmetic, but we can all see that it's only a little bit more than a pound a week. So where in the UK could you, in 1998, get childcare for a pound a week? This was what my younger daughter would call a piece of poo. This was really careful text analysis of the press release suggested that the government was never claiming that it would pay for the childcare places, simply that it would facilitate them. But that wasn't the message that anybody heard, and maybe it wasn't the message the government wanted to give. We hear this kind of story again and again. I'll take the Glen Eagles debt relief package of $50 billion, something that was going to transform third world, that was presented as something that was really a costly move for the rich world. Well, the $50 billion was in fact the stock of debt on which interest was no longer going to be charged. So the interest that was going to be foregone was only $1.5 billion a year, because it was a pretty low interest rate anyway. That already cuts the $50 billion down the size. At the time, the exchange rate, conveniently enough, was $2 to a pound. So that's £750 million, and now it's got millions rather than billions after it. That sounds a lot less scary. What was the population of the group of eight rich countries that were going to write off this debt? Well, this slide claims that it was £750 million. In fact, it was £800 million, but if we pretend it's £750 million, that makes the sum easier, which suggests that the debt relief that was announced in the Glen Eagles settlement would cost each member of the G8, the rich world, £1 per year. Even that, it turns out, was an exaggeration, because most of the spending was going to come from previously set aid budgets, which were not increased as a result of the Glen Eagles settlement. So this was a $50 billion, that on further reflection turned out to be closer to zero. That is immensely depressing. not because it was a bad thing, but because it wasn't understood, because the number was not put in context. I think one of the most difficult challenges facing those who want to get data and numbers taken more seriously is helping people to set them in the right context. There's another problem with numbers that we have to tackle as we hope to see them better used, and that is that the data goes up and down, numbers go up and down, and all too often what turns out to be random fluctuation, chance fluctuation, is taken to be a reflection of underlying causal change. And now I want to talk about these things. Safety cameras, or speed cameras as they're colloquially known. I'm an extremely keen cyclist, so I should preface my remarks by saying that I detest motor car drivers who go too quickly. I think that speeding is demonstrably pretty dangerous. How do you work out how effective these speed cameras work? Now, if I'd been with you, I would have brought along, well, I had in my bag, 50 dice, and we would have played a game, and I'll describe the game, although we can't play it, because I haven't got the dice with you, I have them here with me. I would have asked every member of the conference to imagine that they were a piece of road known well, could be a motorway, could be a roundabout. And then I would have decided that we were going to use the dice to assess how many accidents occurred on each piece of road. I would have given out the dice, one each, and asked you to roll the dice twice, and then add up the number. I would have teased you by asking how many people had scored one, because hopefully nobody would have scored one and rolled the dice twice. And in a group of, I only have 58 dice, in a group of 58 dice, what I tend to see is about five people who score 11 or more, and we would have designated those as the accident black spots. Then I would take a sheet of flip chart paper and drawn five cameras, ripped the paper into pieces, and given one of the cameras to each of the people who had scored 11 or 12. Then I would ask those people to roll their dice twice more to see whether the cameras worked, pointing out that it was important that the camera faced the dice as it would roll. When you play this game with children, they think that you're Darren Brown, because what you expect is that the number of accidents will fall from 11 or 12 to 5 or 6, and that happens repeatedly. I've played this 100 times in the last 2 years. I've never seen the aggregate number of accidents do anything other than fall. It's going to happen to me one day, maybe it will have happened today. This is simply regression to the mean, and all of you will recognize it as regression to the mean if you take a chance event and identify those where something at the extreme happens and then do it again, you'll find that you move back towards the mean. Why play this game in the context of speed cameras? Well, because in the early part of this decade, the Department of Transport released some work estimating the impact of speed cameras on reductions in accidents, and they did exactly what we've just done. They looked for bits of road where there had been more than the average number of accidents. They put cameras there, and they looked to see what would happen to the number of accidents. Well, to the extent that accidents are the result of chance processes, the driver having a heart attack, the driver's telephone going, something exciting happening on the radio, freak weather conditions, a deer running across the road, not entirely chance that one, the process will be exactly the same kind of process as that would be described. I made the point very loudly on radio program, I used to make that one. The Department of Transport said that this was not an issue. 2 years later, they republished their data, having taken regression to the mean into account. 20% of the reduction in accidents they previously claimed they now accepted was the result simply of a long run down the trend in the number of accidents. 60% they accepted was simply regression to the mean. And only 20% of the original claim they now wanted to claim was the result genuinely of the introduction of safety cameras. Now, Alistair Darling, then the Secretary of State of Transport, made the point that any reduction in accidents and deaths is a good thing, and of course he's right. But if you have a public policy that is only one-fifth as effective as you previously thought, and if there are alternative policies, like putting fences around the playground exits for primary schools, more street lighting, more uniformed and marked cars out on the roads, then you will certainly be misallocating your resources if one of your policies is only one-fifth as effective as you believe. This is an example of where statistical understanding, not just the numbers, is important. It's not a subtle point, but it is a very important one, and one that is regularly ignored. The story that we heard this morning about the impact of the smoking ban, I should also say that I'm not and never have been a smoker and think smoking is one of the most stupid things anyone could ever do. The impact of the smoking ban on myocardial infarction, heart attacks, the latest data suggested that it might have led to a 2.4% reduction in hospital admissions, emergency admissions for myocardial infarction. There was some data published a while ago in Scotland suggesting that in the first year, perhaps it had led to an 8% reduction in the number of emergency admissions for heart attack. But that data ignored the fact that the data itself was up and down. And if you went back a number of years, there had been reductions in the number of heart attacks that large without there being the introduction of a ban. Far too frequently, we only interpret numbers and we need to remember that they go up and down. What other kinds of contexts do we need? Well, now I want to talk to you about performance meter. Each winter, we see a story a bit like this, that the winter vomiting bug has gripped the United Kingdom, when we told you 3 million people, this was in the winter of 2007, 3 million people had the winter vomiting bug. Well, how do we know how many people have got the winter vomiting bug? Are we snooping, using webcams on how many people are leaning over their lavatories and throwing up? Are we looking at the concentration of vomit in the sewage pipes? How do we know? Well, there is some underlying data. Here is the data of a period from the beginning of 2000 to the end of 2007. And you'll see that there is an up and down, there is a seasonal fluctuation. But if you look at the y-axis, you'll notice that the number of laboratory reports peaks at around 300. And there are no zeros missing here. 300 is the number of weekly cases of confirmed examples of the norovirus that come through. How can you get from 300 to 3 million? That seems like quite a big jump. Well, the first thing you do, which is typical of this kind of thing, is you add 10 weeks together, which isn't really what the headline suggests. Their 3 million implies 3 million right at any one time. I got it, but no, we add 10 weeks of data together. If you add 10 weeks of data together in the particular year in question, you get to 1,500 cases. That still looks like a very long way from 3 million. Well, we apply a grossing up factor because we know that not everybody who has the winter vomiting bug will end up being seen by a doctor having a sample of the offending body fluid taken and sent off to the laboratory. So we multiply by quite a big number. We assume that there is one lab case for every 1,500 in the community. Sorry, there are 2,000 in those 10 weeks. So from the 2,000 lab cases, we multiply by 1,500, and that gets us to the 3 million. But of course, there is some considerable uncertainty about whether we should multiply by 1,500 or some other number. The 95% confidence interval runs from as low as one person in 140, which would mean just 280,000 cases of the winter vomiting bug, to 1 in 17,000, which would mean 34 million cases, but in a 10-week period, slightly more than half the UK population was throwing up. That information is so broad as to be actually entirely useless. We have no idea how many people each winter actually have the winter vomiting virus. And that's because the number of community cases in the original lab study was just one. When there was a study exactly what was going on in the gastroenterological experience of the whole community, there was only one person. This survey, like so many others, we just don't know. Now you might say, well, that's a problem, but not if you ask everybody, not if you have a census, for example. Well, if you ask everybody, all too often, the responses you get are garbage. This is some data from the US Census, and if you look at the columns in the middle for 1970, you'll see that in 1970, 106,441 US citizens claimed to be age 100 or more. The US Census Bureau believes that the true answer was about 4,800. So even asking people doesn't give you the right answer. How could they get it so wrong? Well, if you're quite old, then it's possible that you're confused. If you're really old, that possibility increases. So maybe some of these really old people were just confused. Maybe some of them wanted to be thought to be older than they really were, and that may be a part of it. But a lot of it seems to be that the way in which the data was collected required people to circle a very small number on a rather closely printed page. And one of the things about getting older is that your eyesight and your ability to circle the number you really, really wanted may diminish over time. This data turned out to be garbage, and the US Census Bureau had to throw it away. Whenever we look at numbers, we need to think very, very hard about where they came from and how they were collected. Every single number that we look at is wrong. It's better and more useful than a description of the world that excludes the numbers, but recognizing its error is terribly, terribly important. Now, I was going to talk about risk, but I'm not going to. I'm going to now ask my friends to give me the results from the multiple choice questions, because very soon I'm going to tell you what the answers were, so let me pick up the phone. So, have we now got some responses? Hi. I've got your responses. Sounds as though for the first question, how much must a child with a couple earn after tax and benefits to be in the top 10%? The majority said 80,000 or more. For the second question, how much has real GDP grown by since 1948? The spread was pretty even, with the majority thinking either 100 or 200. As I've played this with many, many groups, we'll start with the GDP question. I asked this question at the inaugural conference of all of the Treasury's economists 5 or 6 years ago. And their views were not dissimilar to yours, with nearly half of them thinking the answer was 50 or 100%. We'll go through this risk stuff and not use it. Here is a chart that shows you the answer. This is a chart showing you real GDP from 1948 to 2008-2009, indexed to 100 in 2002. I've been slightly unfair. The correct answer is rather more than 300,000, and I didn't give that possibility. Any of you who said 250,000 or 250% or even 200% can get a clap on the back. If you said 150% or less, then you have massively underestimated the rate of growth of the British economy. The UK economy grows on average at 2 3/4% a year. And if there are any other actuaries amongst you, you'll know that 1.0281 raised to the power 25 is 2. So if something grows at 2 3/4% a year, it doubles every 25 years, which is roughly what happens to GDP of the UK. Many of the Treasury's economists thought the answer was 50 or 100%, which would imply the economy growing at either less than 1% or only a little bit more than 1% every year since the war. A misunderstanding which, for attendees at a computational knowledge summit, is perfectly reasonable, but for the people running the British economy, it's terrifying. You'll all know the programme, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? It sounds to me as though if we'd asked the audience on that question, we wouldn't have felt we knew the answer. Here is a picture of the UK income distribution in 2005-06 for the group that I mentioned, childless couples. The stripes, the grey stripes and the yellow stripes, show the 10% to 10 percentiles of the distribution. So you'll see that the top 10% starts at about £38,000 a year in that year, so about £40,000 a year. Now, the top 10% of the UK income distribution for this type of family starts at £40,000 a year. The median income for them was £18,800, so it would be about £20,000 a year. Now, half of such households live on incomes of less than £20,000 a year. So here we have two pieces of information, both of which on average surprised this group. The first is that we are four times as wealthy in terms of income as we were immediately after the war. The second is that we're much, much poorer than we believe ourselves to be on average as a population. That top 10% starts at only £40,000 a year. These responses are uniform with any group that I've done this with. Played this game a few months ago with all of the bishops of the Church of England, and they said exactly the same as you. Now we come to Jim Slick mothers. A technical question, a subtle one. My understanding is fairly even split in your responses, with the two most popular responses being 80,000 or 20,000. If you said 20,000, then again you win the prize. Again, I was unfair to you, I didn't give the true answer because the true answer is only 6,000. Only six of the 780,000 single parents on income support are under the age of 18. Why do we believe that the number is so much greater, which is certainly the prevailing view from all groups? Well, because the media tells us so. And that is why, above all, we need the kind of work that many of you today will be talking about, the kind of work that Walter Mountford is putting in place, to get the truth about many of these things in the public domain. One last example of this. This is a picture that shows the national debt as a percentage of national income. Gordon Brown, when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, said that 40% should be the limit, and you can see that we were above 40% from 1995 to about 1999, and then it fell below, and is now above it and rising steeply, and this has led to enormous anxiety. Let me show you another picture. This is the national debt as a percentage of national income going all the way back to 1692. And the chart I just showed you is just the bottom right-hand corner of that chart. And what you'll see is that in the period from 1750 to 1850, throughout that period, which was a period where the UK's economy dominated the world, the ratio of national debt to national income exceeded 100%. If people are to understand what's going on with national debt, they desperately need this context. My own view is that we've got very confused about the problem here. The ratio of national debt to national income, the stock of debt, is not really something about which we need to be very anxious. What we do need to be very anxious about is the ratio of annual borrowing, the flow of the borrowing as a share of national income, which has reached unprecedented levels and has got to be tackled through either tax increases or public spending reductions. But we focus far too much on the ratio of national debt to national income, which at the moment is really not the problem. And setting that number properly in context makes us realise that we're a long way from the levels that we've seen for much of the last 3 years. One last point to make before I be quiet and see if there are any questions, and that is that, as I hope I showed with some of those questions, our understanding, all of our understanding, and mine as well, of what the world really looks like is poor. I think the most important way in which it's poor is that the mirror held up to us by the media of the world in which we live is unbelievably cracked. It doesn't portray anything very accurately about the context in which we should see ourselves. Here is a chart that shows you how many deaths there have to be from different causes before you get a story on the BBC News. 8,571 deaths from smoking before there's a story on the BBC News, 4,714 from alcohol abuse, 7,500 from obesity, but one quarter of one death from measles, one third of one death from human variant CJD, nearly 20 from HIV positive, 1,222 from mental health problems. And this is not just a broadcasting issue. If you look at the newspapers, you see essentially the same pattern, although you need far fewer deaths from alcohol before you get a newspaper story, because the newspapers are quite interested in celebrities thinking them to death. Why does all this matter? Well, much of what I've said suggested that numbers can be wrong. I think all numbers are wrong. But they're also much the most powerful way of understanding the world in which we live, much more powerful than describing it without using numbers in almost every case. And so although numbers are flawed, numbers set in their proper context actually allow an understanding of the world in which we live, the policy problems that we face, and the consequences of tackling them in different ways. If we don't understand them, we will make terrible mistakes. This has often happened in the last 25 years of public policy in the UK. So the kind of initiatives that those of you who are speaking today are taking have my wholehearted support, a deep desire that we should make a success of this kind of thing, because until we do, we'll go on with an impoverished debate that fails to take account of much the best way of describing the complicated world in which we live. Thank you very much. I don't, I'm afraid, no. my colleague Michael Glasson does for the BBC.
I'm deeply suspicious of numbers, but I don't know in what context all numbers are wrong exists. What context are you referring to when you say all numbers are wrong?
What context are you referring to when you say that all numbers are wrong?
So that's a very good question. It's not quite true, I think, to say that all numbers are wrong. Numbers, when they're entirely abstract, are within their context right. So the statement 2 plus 2 equals 4 is right. But even a statement of the form, there are 5 sheep in that field, turns out to be really quite complicated. How many of them are rams and how many of them are ewes? How many of them are lambs? How many of them are pregnant? It turns out that as soon as we try to count anything, it becomes very, very difficult. Nothing like so accurate as we expect. Any sample will be, however good it is, unrepresentative. Any census will have some people, like those US centenarians, who give the wrong answer. We all know that accounting, although often seen by the inexpert as being absolutely precise science, is in fact an art. Issues of the definition, issues of counting are terribly important. So they're not perfect, but they will always be better than not trying to quantify. When I say they're all wrong, all that I'm trying to get people to recognize is that there is a difficulty in quantification, and that too often, when those difficulties are pointed out, people then say, oh, we must throw everything away, that the lie, damn lie is a statistics story. Of course, there will be a problem whenever we try to count something, but it will always be a much better way of describing something than an attempt to describe it that uses no numbers, that simply relies on words other than numbers.
Okay, there are any questions?
Sorry, just as a fellow cyclist, you've got a graph there of deaths per story for various health conditions. I would love to see that graph of deaths per story for different modes of transport.
Yes, so would I, and I can't off the top of my head tell you all of the numbers, but I will give you another example of how this can go so badly wrong. I used to travel up and down from London to Oxford on the train a lot, so I was doing that around the time of the Southern Rail crash, a terrible crash in which many, many people were killed. But 30 people, I think, died in the Southern Rail crash. 3,000 people die every year on Britain's roads, and the number of deaths on Britain's railways has continued to decline. Yet in the aftermath of the Southern Rail crash, a number of politicians made statements of the fall that whatever it cost, there would be reforms to signalling and railway lines and train safety to prevent anything like this ever happening again. Well, we can't prevent anything like that ever happening again. And there was quite a lot of evidence that it probably would have been better to spend any extra money on improving road safety rather than rail safety. But in the aftermath of that crash, nobody wanted to know the numbers that compared those various types of transport. And precisely that kind of graph is exactly what you need to decide where you should spend the money.
Okay,
questions.
Will this presentation be made available and sacrificed all the other?
Will this presentation be made available?
I don't see any reason why not. I see no reason why not. There might be some technical issues, but I'm sure we can do that.
And our plan is to put quite a few of them up onto the website that promote this.
How can we all learn to understand numbers properly?
I think two things to say. First of all, that it's easier than people think, and the most important thing is to overcome the fear or hesitation that stops us interrogating numbers. So we allow people to use numbers, and we allow them to imply the meaning rather than thinking about it. If I said a sentence that didn't make any sense, then almost everybody would say, well, that's clearly stupid. But when last year there were two examples on the BBC News that I saw that made me shudder. The first was a story about bat-side missions, and I think it was Hugh Edwards was the newscaster, and he came on screen. He said, well, new study has shown that if we all switch from high energy to low energy light bulbs, there would be a reduction in carbon dioxide emissions of 5 tons. Well, first of all, I think he missed off a million. He must have meant 5 million tons. But without knowing what carbon dioxide emissions for the UK are, you've got no idea whether that's a good number at all. Absolutely none. I looked at the way I looked, and I think the answer is it's about 600 million. So this was a reduction of about 1%. When you hear a story like that, don't just let it wash over you. Think, well, what on earth does that mean? Or when, if you heard the story this morning about the £8.4 million reduction in the NHS, ask yourself the question, well, what is the total NHS budget? The easiest way of making many of these things interpretable is to bring them down to the level of the individual. So my favourite number in the UK is £3.12 billion, because £3.12 billion is £1 per person per week in the UK. When you get a big number, cut it down to what it means for the individual, and that makes it much more comprehensible. So rather than talking about £700 billion of public spending, which is the total level of public spending, which means almost nothing to anybody, you say, well, let's divide that by 60 million, which is not too difficult to do even without a calculator, and it's £11,000 per person per year in the UK. So often, bringing the numbers down to what it means to you as an individual will make a great deal of sense.
I think we have time for one more question.
Andrew, is there a way of benchmarking absolute truth? So if you've got a model, it says like pi is 100% and this stat is 2%.
Is there a benchmark for absolute truth?
A benchmark for absolute truth in data? No, I think there isn't, and I think we probably get into the wrong area if we try to assert that there is. All of the data that we work with is imperfect, and so we have to recognise always that it's pretty contingent. But it's better than not having it. So, the college in which I work, we have 600 students. Now, if I didn't count the number, counting the number of students turned out to be tricky. Some of them arrive late, some of them, if they're doing graduate degrees, they leave early because somebody offers them a job, so they stop halfway through their doctorate. So I never know exactly how many students I've got. If you were to ask me how many students are there at St. Hugh's College, Oxford, now, I could give you an answer, but it wouldn't actually be precisely correct. But it's much better than saying, well, I don't know, somewhere between 300 and 700. I can do better than that. So my own feeling is that we just should accept the imperfection in data and not try to claim that something's absolutely right, because it rarely will be, and very little has to be absolutely right.